Good evening. The Senate and House are on a collision course over the migrant crisis at the southern border. Iran and the United States stumbling towards war and another upset in Queens. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, June 26, 2019. The Republican-led Senate on Wednesday passed a $4.6 billion bill to address the migrant crisis at the southern border, setting up a clash with House Democrats who have passed a different version of similar legislation. The House of Representatives voted Tuesday to approve $4.5 billion in aid for the growing crisis at the border, and the bill has significant differences with the Senate proposal. The House vote followed Democratic infighting over the package and a White House veto threat. Four liberal Democratic freshmen voted against the measure, Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, Ayanna Presley of Massachusetts, Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, and Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. The growing humanitarian crisis on the southern border was further galvanized Tuesday afternoon after the release of the shocking image depicting the drowned corpses of the father and daughter. The bodies were found Monday near Matamoros across the river from Brownsville, Texas. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer described the photograph where the father and daughter are holding onto each other. He said her tiny head tucked inside his shirt, her arm draped around his neck.
President Trump, I want you to look at this photo. These are not drug dealers or vagrants or criminals. They are people simply fleeing a horrible situation in their home country for a better life.
And Senate Homeland Security Chairman Ron Johnson appeared to choke up when referring to the photo during a Senate immigration hearing.
I didn't have time to have a picture blown up, but we've all seen it. Of Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez and his 23-month-old daughter, Valeria. Now, I realize tragedies occur all over this country, all over the world. I don't want to see another picture like that on the U.S. border. I hope that picture alone will catalyze this Congress, this Senate, this committee to do something. I called up Senator Peters earlier this morning. I said I had half a mind to canceling this hearing and instead just have a discussion between what I believe are U.S. senators of good faith that have sat through 30 more hearings of this problem on the border and start coming to some conclusions. What can we agree on to actually start improving the situation?
It's not clear whether the House and Senate would be able to reach an agreement the president would sign off on or if Trump would back the GOP-led Senate bill. And the House Oversight and Reform Committee on Wednesday voted to subpoena White House counselor Kellyanne Conway after she did not appear voluntarily at a hearing focused on her repeated alleged violations of the Hatch Act.
Roll call is ordered of approving the resolution to subpoena Ms. Conway. The clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Cummings?
Aye.
Mr. Cummings votes aye. Ms. Maloney?
The committee voted 25-16 to compel Conway's testimony following roughly 30 minutes of arguments over the validity of the Office of Special Counsel's findings that she repeatedly violated the law, which prohibits federal officials from weighing in on elections in their government capacity. Representative Justin Amash of Michigan was the lone Republican to side with Democrats to authorize the subpoena. The White House blocked Conway from appearing for public testimony before the committee Wednesday, citing longstanding precedent of declining to offer presidential advisors for congressional testimony. And as tensions heat up in the Middle East, President Trump said Wednesday that a war with Iran would not last very long or involve ground troops, dismissing warnings that limited U.S. military action could spiral into a larger conflict. Trump reiterated his desire to avoid a war, but said, "We're in a very strong position if something should happen. It wouldn't last very long, I can tell you that," he said during a wide-ranging interview on Fox Business. "I'm not talking boots on the ground," Trump added. "I'm not talking. We're going to send 1 million soldiers. I'm just saying if something would happen, it wouldn't last very long. On Wednesday, Iran suggested it was just one day from breaching a threshold in the 2015 international nuclear deal that limited its stockpile of uranium, a move that would pressure European countries aiming to be neutral to pick sides. Ervand Abrahamian is a historian of the Middle East specializing in modern Iran. He says the conflict between the United States and Iran is rooted in Trump's hostility to President Obama and the desire of Saudi Arabia and Israel to have the UN, the United States, destroy a country they consider a threat.
U.S. spends about $1 trillion on the military. Iran spends something like $13 billion on the military. That $13 billion is far less than what the Saudis spend, even what the United Arab Emirates send. So Iran is not a military threat in any way. But U.S. sees it as a threat mainly because of its U.S. actions in Afghanistan, Iraq, in Syria. In all those places, Iran has increased its influence mainly by getting local supporters because of U.S. actions, especially the invasion of Iraq. But if you go back a few years before the Iraqi invasion and before the invasion of Afghanistan, and before the U.S. trying to overthrow Assad, Iran's influence in those countries was very limited. It has increased because of basically what the U.S. has done. These are local actors who are allied to Iran. They're not really proxies or agents of Iran.
Why threaten and take the chance of a huge war with a country that's a minor military power and is only has a really minor role in aggravating the United States and a few other countries? I could think of worse actors in this world along those lines.
A number of reasons I think Trump has chosen Iran as enemy number one for the time being. One is to undo anything that Obama had done, and Obama's main achievement was the nuclear agreement. Another reason is Trump got elected with the help of Likud, and Likud sees Iran as an existential threat. Israel actually was adamantly opposed to the nuclear deal. It wanted Obama to attack Iran. And since Obama didn't oblige, they were very much interested in replacing Obama with Trump, who promised to get rid of the agreement. Then there's the Saudi factor. The Saudis feel that Iran is a major threat to them. Going back to the Wahhabi or Sunni conflict with Iran, and they would like United States to come in and destroy Iran, and that way they would feel safer that there is no Iran next to themselves. Allies of United States, Israel and Saudi Arabia, have a vested interest to escalate the crisis.
When we attack a country and supposedly destroy it, they might come back stronger.
Definitely. If Trump wants to withdraw from Afghanistan, and he's talked of withdrawing from Syria, what that means is actually Iran's influence will increase in those countries even more. So because of what U.S. has done in the past.
What do you think a war would be like?
Their thinking in Washington is if they put squeeze on Iran, the regime will collapse. And the squeeze first is, of course, with sanctions. If that doesn't work, they'll start doing some bombing of the nuclear installations. And that wouldn't, I don't think, will bring down the regime. So then they will have to think of something even worse. And in the meanwhile, of course, Iran would have retaliated. They could start using their influence in Afghanistan, Syria, and Iraq to undermine U.S. positions there. So the road they're following is basically a road towards a collision.
Ervand Abrahamian is a historian of the Middle East specializing in modern Iran. You can hear more about Iran and the United States on this air Sunday at 11 a.m. with WBAI's Jim Dingman, who's hosting the program Crisis in the Gulf. And Russian President Vladimir Putin will meet with U.S. President Donald Trump on the sidelines of an international summit in Japan, the Kremlin said Wednesday, in talks that come amid bitter differences between Moscow and Washington. Trump has said he plans to meet with Putin during the Group of 20 summit in Osaka, and Putin has said he welcomes dialogue and is ready to sit down for talks. Wednesday's statement by Putin's foreign affairs advisor, Yuri Ushakov, marked the official Kremlin confirmation of the two presidents' meeting on Friday. Ushakov said the meeting is set to last about an hour, though it will be up to the presidents to decide. He added that the talks are expected to touch on arms control issues and international crises, including the Iranian nuclear deal, Syria, North Korea, and Ukraine. And in the Caribbean, a Russian Navy frigate armed with cruise missiles arrived in Havana, Cuba for an official visit on Monday. Meanwhile, Expedia Group, the digital travel industry conglomerate, has agreed to pay $325,000 to the U.S. government for breaching Cuban travel sanctions between 2011 and 2014. The news comes at a time when Trump's reneging of Obama-era negotiations with the Caribbean nation. Trump has announced new restrictions on travel to Cuba from the U.S., barring cruise ships from visiting the country and banning people-to-people travel. This includes organized tour groups, one of the primary ways U.S. citizens have visited Cuba. Ike Nahim represents the New York, New Jersey, Cuba Sea Coalition. He says since the failure of a United States-sponsored coup in Venezuela, the administration has turned to Cuba in an attempt to overthrow the Cuban Revolution.
This Friday, there'll be a protest action at the United States Mission to the United Nations. It's going to be organized to protest the latest measures by the Trump administration against Cuba. Further restrictions on the right to travel, ending the waiver of Title III of the Helms-Burton law that was signed by Bill Clinton way back when, that is the basis for the U.S. economic war against Cuba. And since the defeat of the Washington's attempt to organize a military coup in Venezuela, since that failed, Trump has pivoted to try to blame that failure on Cuba. So these measures have been announced, and we're just gathering together to protest that and to signal that the Cuba Solidarity Forces in the United States are on a campaign to fight against these measures.
How do you plan over time to fight against these measures? What are your plans for that?
We've been fighting against them for a long time. You know, they first came into effect shortly after the triumph of the Cuban Revolution, and have had ups and downs with various degrees through the last 11 or so administrations. It's been basically the bipartisan policy of the U.S. government to overturn the Cuban Revolution and destroy that example. And there was some advances made in the last couple of years of the Obama administration in terms of loosening enforcement of the travel restrictions, and although the embargo remained. So now Trump is reversing much of that, although not all of it. Diplomatic relations haven't been severed. But it is going back to the way the policies were under Clinton, Reagan, both Bushes, and the first part of Obama. So unfortunately, we have a lot of experience in fighting it and just take advantage of whatever openings we have to stress that and try to raise it as an issue, including in the upcoming elections in the U.S.
Have you been to Cuba?
Many times. I usually go at least once a year.
And is it possible still to go? What are the exact effects for someone who travels to Cuba? What are the effects of the Trump administration now?
There are still legal possibilities and the category of people-to-people exchanges, which was a category that had been legal and that many people and groups had used to go over there as part of licensed groups, which is what they make you do. So that category has been abolished, but there's other categories that people are seeing about organizing trips. Cruise ship stops have been stopped completely, and a lot of U.S. citizens have visited Cuba through these cruise ship, so that option has ended for now. But, you know, it's still possible to go legally. There's still flights that go directly even from the United States. But, you know, the aim of the Trump administration has been to narrow that considerably. And, of course, other possibilities of going that have been loosened under Obama, including exchanges, artists, musicians, family members, doctors, scientists, those kind of exchanges have also been cut down because the staff of the U.S. Embassy to issue visas for Cubans coming to the United States has been, you know, stripped to almost nothing. And so
what are they trying to who are they trying to keep from going to Cuba? They're obviously allowing people who are already believers in the Cuban Revolution to go, but they seem to be out to stop people from learning more about it who don't know.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's always been in the view of those of us that, you know, are involved in the fight around Cuba. That's always been sort of the bottom line, is that they do not want to return dozens of trips to Cuba of trade unionists and African-American activists and young people. Over the years, many, many trips. And the thing that is almost universal that I get from people that have gone on the trips that I've organized, even the ones that are already sympathetic and knowledgeable about Cuba, you know, the sort of the chasm between the propaganda and what they actually see. You know, not to minimize any of the obvious challenges that Cuba faces, but the Cuban reality, you know, is so different than the propaganda. When people see that and they see, you know, what kind of society Cuba has and is building, then, you know, many of the people that do go down there, they come back here and they're committed to fighting against the U.S. policy. So I do believe that, you know, the main reason they want to keep people out of Cuba is because they don't want the truth of the Cuban reality to be known.
Ike Nahum represents the New York, New Jersey, Cuba Sea Coalition. And the divide in the state of Oregon between the state's liberal cities and its conservative and economically depressed rural areas has made the state a fertile ground for the political crisis unfolding over a push by Democrats to enact sweeping climate legislation. 11 Republican senators are entering the seventh day of a walkout Wednesday to deny the supermajority Democrats the number of lawmakers needed to vote on a cap and trade bill, which would be second of its kind in the U.S. The stalemate has drawn international attention, in part because right-wing militias have rallied to the GOP cause. One Republican lawmaker said state troopers dispatched to hunt down the striking lawmakers should come heavily armed if they want to bring him back to the Capitol. This is not the Oregon way and cannot be rewarded, Democratic Governor Kate Brown said. The Republicans are driving us away from the values that Oregonians hold dear and are moving us dangerously close to the self-serving stalemate in Washington, D.C. Experts say the standoff was inevitable given the state's political makeup. Oregon has a national reputation as a liberal bastion, best known for its craft beer, donuts, and award-winning wine. But while its cities lean left, about 40% of residents, mostly those in rural areas, consistently vote Republican. That's according to Priscilla Southwell, a University of Oregon professor who wrote the book Governing Oregon. The reality, she said, is that it's a much more divided state than people realize. It's kind of like a perfect storm for this kind of thing to happen. The political divide also translates to an economic chasm for many as Portland has boomed. Huge swaths of the state have been left without enough money to keep libraries open or fully staff sheriff's departments. Logging, which once thrived, has been significantly reduced because of environmental restrictions and a changing global economy. Rural voters worry the climate legislation would be the end for logging and trucking. It's going to ruin so many lives. It's going to put so many people out of work, said Bridget Hasbrook, a self-employed logger from Dallas, Oregon. If the guys that I'm cutting for can't afford to run their logging companies, then I have to figure out something different. The proposal would dramatically reduce greenhouse gases over 30 years by capping carbon emissions and requiring businesses to buy or trade from an ever-dwindling pool of pollution allowance. Democrats say the legislation is critical to make Oregon a leader in the fight against climate change and will ultimately create jobs and transform the economy. Republicans say it will kill jobs, raise the cost of fuel and other goods, and gut small businesses. They also say they've been left out of policy negotiations, an assertion the governor called hogwash. And in New York City news, 2 days after dozens of people were arrested outside of the New York Times building while protesting the paper's climate coverage, close to 100 protesters gathered outside City Hall on Monday afternoon to support a city council resolution that would declare a climate emergency in New York City. The resolution was first proposed by Councilmember Ben Kalos, requiring the city to install battery storage systems on city-owned buildings and construct geothermal and solar power programs for hot water heating and electricity. Though short on details, the resolution calls for an immediate emergency mobilization to restore a safe climate. The rally was organized by Extinction Rebellion and the Sunrise Movement, among other groups. And in related news, Wednesday and Thursday night, contenders for Democratic Party nomination to confront Donald Trump in 2020 will meet in their first debate to be broadcast on television at 9 p.m. on the East Coast. Tonight's debate will feature Senator Elizabeth Warren and tomorrow Senator Bernie Sanders, the leading lights among progressives. They're supporting aspects of what's come to be called the Green New Deal to reinvigorate the economy along ecological lines. Stephen O'Hanlon is a representative of the Sunshine Movement. He says it's not enough for the candidates to provide sound bites on the environment.
It's clear that ahead of these debates that huge majorities of Democratic voters want substantive discussion on climate change. They realize this is an emergency and it threatens our very survival. We really hope that the moderators and the Democratic National Committee take this crisis seriously and make sure it gets the airtime it needs.
Are there any of the people who are running who are more in line than others? I mean, we talk about Bernie and Elizabeth Warren. Are they on the top of your list, or do you think that all of them have something to offer, or any of them don't?
We have an open mind right now. It's not only a few of the have put out really detailed policy platforms so far, candidates have an opportunity to prove to our generation that they are ready to stand with us and take on the oil and gas lobby. And we're really excited that a huge number of the candidates have backed the Green New Deal, signed the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge, and are also calling for a climate debate, which is really important as well.
Tell us about the lawsuit. How's that doing right now? Where's that at?
Sunrise is not leading the lawsuit. So I'd want to defer to the folks who are leading that to talk about that. But we fully support the young people who are pushing the lawsuit.
Tell me a little bit about Sunrise. What do you do as a group?
We were founded in 2017, and we are organizing all across the country. We have over 250 chapters. And we're fighting to make our political system work for our generation and take our generation's survival seriously, and vote out politicians who are answering to oil and gas lobbyists and not our generation.
And how is that going? I mean, do you find resistance, or are people responding to your appeal?
Ordinary people are really resonating with it. People are sick and tired of some of the wealthiest people on this earth getting to write the rules and get around regulations that are designed to protect our health and safety. Huge majorities of Americans back policies like the Green New Deal, where they would create millions of good jobs, they would reinvigorate our economy, and make sure that we have a livable future to grow up in. And so people all across the country really, really are with us. Unfortunately, some of the establishment politicians and establishment organizations like the Democratic National Committee are not taking this crisis as seriously as we would like. And obviously, Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell are denying it outright.
Do you mostly do like lobbying or protesting, marching? What's the main thrust of your activity?
Like I said, we have 250 chapters all across the country. And they do a variety of different things, and meeting with representatives, getting local politicians signed on to back the Green New Deal on a city or state level. We right now have a sit-in going on outside the Democratic National Committee where we are calling on them to host a climate debate because we can't debate we can't expect candidates to debate our survival in just a few sound bites.
Stephen O'Hanlon is a representative of the Sunrise Movement. And in more local climate news, last night, Manhattan Community Board 3 voted to support with conditions a $1.45 billion three-and-a-half-year program to reconstruct and raise East River Park, one of the largest environmental projects in New York City history. The East Side Coastal Resiliency Project will begin in 2020 with potentially the closure of the entire park. Tuesday night's approval included demands that the city vet the project with independent experts before construction begins. And finally, Governor Andrew Cuomo insisted that Democratic Socialist Tiffany Cabin's apparent win in Tuesday's hotly contested primary for Queens District Attorney is thanks to low turnout and nothing more. Of the 766,107 enrolled Democratic voters in the borough, 85,447 voted in Tuesday's primary for DA, about 11%. Cabin's claimed victory Tuesday night, running against establishment candidate and Cuomo-backed borough president Melinda Katz, along with former prosecutor and judge Greg Lassick, Mina Malik, Jose Nieves, and Betty Lugo. But Katz refused to concede, instead calling for a recount. Unofficial results show Cabin with 39.57% and Katz with 38.3%, a difference of less than 1,100 votes. 3,400 paper and absentee ballots need to be counted before the vote is official. Cabin has been endorsed by two presidential contenders, Senators
Cabin.
Cabin, thank you very
Cabin.
Much. Cabin, you know that. Thank you very much, Cabin, and I'll report. Cabin has been endorsed by two presidential contenders, Senators Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts and Bernie Sanders of Vermont, as well as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She spent her career working as a public defender in Queens, where she was born and raised. The winner moves on to the November general election against a Republican challenger and the final race to succeed longtime District Attorney Richard Brown, who died last month at age 86. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, June 26, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry, Emily Whitney, and our engineer, Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.